I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. And this is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
Welcome back to another emergency edition of Australian Golf Passport. Soon we're making a habit of this, Maddie. Matt Mollick is with me, and we've also got a special guest to chat about some news that broke today in Aussie golf.
Hi, Scott. Yeah, it seemed like a good time to talk about what's been a really big issue in Australian golf for the last year or two and seems to be coming to a head in your town, unfortunately.
Yeah, and obviously any issue that's important to the game of golf in Australia, no better voice to have and no better perspective to have than Mike Clayton, who's kindly made some time tonight. So, Clayton, welcome.
Thank you, Scott. I'm looking forward to it. Discussing this issue.
We've talked about having you back on before the end of the year, and I hope that we'll be able to do a proper one, because we've got some questions, just that a bit more funny and enjoyable questions for Mike Clayton. But yeah, obviously this morning the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has announced that in a couple of years' time, Moore Park Golf Course, which is I think the third busiest golf course in Australia, according to Golf Australia, is losing half its holes so that the residents in the apartments over the road have somewhere to recreate. Obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is that there's about 300 hectares of green space all around them there that's often empty. But we'll get through the announcement and then I guess a bit of how did it get to this and what does golf do next. But Moore Park, obviously, right on the eastern outskirts of the Sydney CBD, Green Square and Zetland, traditionally industrial parts of town. Clayton, you pointed out on Twitter earlier today that they were the home of the Slazenger and PGF factories, which is a perverse little link to golf. But yeah, Now very residential, now very high-rised, not blessed with a lot of green space within their footprint. And so people are looking nearby for available green space. And of course, golf's the obvious target, isn't it?
Well, it's an easy target because most people don't play golf, but it's also one of the top one, two, or three participation sports in the country. Incredibly popular. Every golf course you go to is packed. I don't know how many rounds they do a year, probably 50, 60, 70,000 rounds a year.
Yeah, about 60,000.
Yeah, so that's an incredibly busy golf course by any standards. So, you know, taking away golf it's bad for golf. But, I mean, my point's always been that the problem with the public course model in Australia is that councils generally lease them out to an operator who never spends any money on the architecture because, one, he's got to pay for it. Two, it's disruptive, so he loses money that way. And three, he can't really put the green fees up once it's finished, no matter how much better the golf course is. So the only way that the biggest, most impressive work done on a public course in Australia was at Sandringham, done by my ex-partners at OCM, who the government gave the facility and Golf Australia the money to build Golf Australia's offices and to redo the golf course. And that golf course went from being a dope 3 to a dope 5, probably, which is a significant jump.
Yeah.
And it's a much better golf course now than it was. But, you know, that was an exception. That was because the state government had a premier who liked golf and decided that golf needed some investment, and for the long-term betterment of the game, it's been brilliant. Yeah. And you know, the driving range is making a fortune, the golf course is packed, and people are playing fabulous golf. And the way to make golf, I've always thought, more popular is to have better golf courses and better architecture. So, you know, and we're working at Wembley now in West Australia, which might be the busiest 36-hole place in the world, 26 million balls on the driving range and 180,000 rounds a year. Staggering numbers. I mean, partly they're redoing the newer second course, which is not very good because they need more car parking. I mean, the place is unbelievably busy. But because that's operated by the council, they're taking it upon themselves to redo it. And it's typical of Perth golf. It's not very good golf on the best suburban land for golf in Australia. In terms of, I mean, Perth's got, I think undoubtedly the best, perhaps maybe not ahead of the Sandbelt, but I would argue it is, you know, the best suburban land in the country for golf. It's incredible land.
Yeah.
Great vegetation, great undulation, all sand. It's unbelievable. It's perfect land for golf.
Yeah. And I guess the perverse thing about Moore Park is that it's actually for Sydney, it's on some of the better land and better soil for golf. I guess, unfortunately, it's right in the middle of, you know, a global city of 5, 6, probably soon to be 7 million. And all those people have got to go somewhere. A lot of them are going in nearby. It just seems that it's that psychology around, you know, golf being an elite sport. And reality is, full membership at Moore Park, you can pay by the month, and it boils down to $53 a week. You know, a high schooler can play it for $25. Yeah. A uni student can play it for $30. Seniors pay $30. Like, this is a highly affordable facility. And you would think that it's the kind of thing that a city should want to have in it. You know, it's a great public golf facility. It's defending that green space. You know, if they're saying that green space is precious, you know, golf is one way of locking up green space. And even for the people who don't play golf, the benefits of being adjacent to 150 acres of green space are huge. So I think people mistake the issue. And I think sometimes they thrive on, oh, we're sticking it to the man. But, you know, the people they're sticking it to by taking away half of Moore Park are tradies and teachers and hospitality workers and students, and, you know, they're carrying on like they're reclaiming the Aussie.
Well,
which, you know,
and especially in that part of the city where to join, I mean, when we worked at the Lakes, it was 33,000 to join. I assume the Australians more than that.
The Aussie now is about 52 and best part of 10 grand a year.
Yeah. So it's important to have public golf in that area for people who want to play golf. And, you know, okay. Fine if you're going to take nine holes. I mean, I'm not sure why you can't do what the busiest and best course in the world does, which is it's shut on Sundays. The old course is shut. And anyone can walk on the old course anytime they want. It's all part of the town. So, and they've managed that perfectly happily for 300 years.
Because, and I think you touch on something that's crucial, which is, like, there is a consultation about how this will work, and they're talking about not just taking, so Moore Park's on a northern paddock and a southern paddock. Northern paddock has the driving range, clubhouse and 12 holes. Southern paddock has 6 holes. They're not talking about just taking that second paddock and converting it, which would be one thing. They're saying, well, we need the western part of the main paddock because it's closest to the homes. And so there will be a form of consultation. And I think one thing that the golf community needs to do is make arguments like you've just made, which is, okay, instead of taking the golf course, cutting it in half and basically guaranteeing a slow death, why don't we do that? Why don't we say Sundays it's public park? You know, why don't we look at these other ways that allows the golf to coexist rather than there being winners and losers?
Well, even if you know, as silly as it sounds, close it on the weekend. Make it a public park on the weekend. Or make nine holes, make half of it a public park on the weekend or whatever. You know, there's got to be, I think, some sort of compromise. And if nothing else, okay, if you want to take nine holes, but give a decent architect, we'll volunteer, $3 or $4 million and rebuild what's left with the brief to make it the best nine-hole course in the world.
And, yeah.
You know, to make something the best nine-hole course in the world isn't that hard, probably. There aren't that many. You played Royal Wellington and Newmarket, no doubt. You know, amazing nine-hole course in England near Cambridge. But yeah. Wouldn't be hard to make certainly one of the best 10 nine-hole courses in the world.
Also, Clay, it's like in Sydney. Sydney's not a golf city the way Melbourne is. You could probably, that nine-holer could probably be the, you know, top 10 in the top 10 in Sydney, which comfortably. So you actually would have an opportunity to give it a whole new identity and appeal. Yeah. But just slicing off a whole bunch of land and leaving them with what they're left with is just, that's not the answer, I think, in terms of making sure this great asset stays. You know, and the thing that scares me is that, like, this is happening all across Australia, particularly in the big eastern seaboard cities. You know, Brisbane nuked the Victoria Park course a handful of years ago. Matty Clates, down your way. What, Elsternwick went 10 years ago now?
Elsternwick went, yeah, which is a... I mean, I haven't been driven past there for a while, but I don't think that's in any great... It's certainly not a pristine botanical garden.
No. Norfolk obviously had those issues during COVID, and now Oakleigh is under fire. Like, this is not just a Moorpark problem. This is a problem for golf in major urban centres in Australia.
Definitely. And Sandy Jamieson's finding that out front and centre at Oakleigh. Doesn't matter how much community engagement and various community groups are utilising that facility and how much of a service he's doing for constituents in that council. It just seems like City Hall's out to get him, essentially. And it's sort of looking on from a distance. It's felt like that at Moorpark for a while as well, with Clover sort of having the course in her sights.
Yeah,
and now, unfortunately, the premier. Scott, I was going to ask earlier, that area around the golf course, that's seen obviously huge development in the last decade and increase in population in that area of 2 or 3 square kilometres.
Yeah, it has. Probably a bit more than a decade. And it really dates to, which is, I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but it's ironic to me that the two people who've been fighting most passionately to take Moorpark Golf Course are Clover Moore and Bob Carr, who was premier at the time that this all these rezoning happened of Green Square and Zetland and Rosebery. Sorry, not Rosebery. This is how it is because of the decisions that they made. And there was an opportunity to include green space for the people in these communities that they've created, and they didn't do it. It just, it's odd to me that they're the ones who are waging this war. I mean, it's literally 300 hectares of green space between Moorpark, Centennial Park and Queen's Park. If you go to the west of Green Square and Zetland, you've got Sydney Park, Redfern Park, Waterloo Park. Up towards Central Station is Prince Alfred Park. Like, there's, Sydney is a global city that's not short of green space. You go into the city centre, you've got Hyde Park, and on the eastern side of Circular Quay, you've got the Domain and Royal Botanic Gardens that are gigantic. Like, it may not be on their doorstep, but it just feels like this is an opportunistic targeting of golf rather than solving a legitimate problem that exists. I mean, I used to live pre-children right near Centennial Park and used to spend a ton of time there because my apartment didn't have any outdoor area. The place is empty most of the time. You know, it's busy on weekends, granted, and so that goes to Clates' point of, okay, well, let's give them Moorpark Golf Course on the weekends or on Sundays.
After 1 o'clock or whatever on Saturdays and all day, whatever. But, you know, there's got to be some sort of compromise there. Or, as I said, well, if you're going to take it, then invest in what's left to make it miles better. Do it. They did it at Sandringham and make the golf much better.
Yeah. I mean, a thing that if it needs to change in some way, you know, time is the most precious commodity most people have these days. There's 12 holes on the main paddock as it is. I mean, one of the things you could do to stand apart from other golf courses is, okay, abandon the southern yep. paddock. That's a park. Moorpark is now a 12-hole golf course. Perfect. So, hey, you got 2.5 hours spare, 3 hours spare. You can play a full round of golf, 12 holes. Yeah, it would actually be, again, it's just every alternative, even if you compromise and say, all right, we're going to have to hand some golf back because it's an urban area and, you know, it's 2023. I get that. But kind of every alternative to the one they've chosen is better for the golf.
Yeah. Yeah, just taking nine. Well, I mean, taking nine holes sounds, which presumably is part of the negotiation, which should be headed by James Sutherland, I assume. It's Golf Australia. It's there. Isn't that their responsibility, or certainly the New South Wales Golf Association? You know, that should be part of the discussion with the government. Is, okay, well, if you're going to do something here, then here's a better way to do it. 12 holes, 18 holes, but we're happy to have it closed at 1 o'clock on Saturdays and all day Sunday, or, you know, all day Monday or whatever. But, you know, and point out that, of course, Chris Minns won't, I assume, have any clue what happens at St Andrews, but would be pretty easy to point out, well, the busiest and best golf course in the world is shut to the public and has been for 300 years on Sundays.
Yeah.
So why not do that?
Well, yeah. You had Josh Ralston on State of the Game recently, Clates, and he was talking about sharing North Berwick with pedestrians and people walking their dogs and people walking their dogs through Sunningdale as well.
Well, so, well, golf is just a shared game with the community in Scotland, because most of the links courses start in the town, go out and come back to the town. Dornoch and Brora and Carnoustie and St Andrews and, you know, Panmure and Monty. So many of these places, that's what they do. So they're, you know, intertwined with the fabric of the town and the society, and people who don't play golf still use the golf course. And that's what should happen here. You know, I mean, there are way too many fences around golf courses in Australia. Just pull the fences down. Even the private clubs.
Golf needs to rebrand it in Australia. Like, it's not what people perceive it to be. And there's not going to be less demand for space in major cities. And so I think golf actually has to be proactive about doing exactly that, Clates. Get the fences down, put walking paths through the edges of the properties, you know, be seen to be inclusive with surrounding communities rather than, there's a 10-foot fence with barbed wire on the top and don't you come in because you haven't paid, you know, the Johnny fee. That's just, it's not going to play well for golf in the long term. And I think golf needs to kind of circle the wagons now, and there needs to be a central voice that everyone's pulling together, because places like Moore Park as well, I mean, yeah, this doesn't affect the major private clubs, but the pipeline of golf, like, all of us start playing golf at public courses.
Yep.
Very few people are born into the game and join a private club and are away. So if the private clubs don't do something, I think, to try and that's where a lot of the influence lives, and that's where a lot of the connections live. If private golf doesn't do something to try to help public golf, I actually think 20, 30 years down the line, there'll be an impact for those clubs.
Yep.
I wonder if there's been any action from that upper set of clubs in Sydney, the Australian, the Lakes, New South, Bonnie Doon, some of the North Shore courses, if they're, how concerned they are and what they've actually done behind the scenes.
Probably about as much as the Sandbelt clubs have done to help Northcote and Oakley. Like, I think self-interest is a very powerful thing, isn't it? And
yeah, I mean, Oakley's not on the radar of, I mean, I'm a member at Metro, which is literally 5 minutes down the road. I guarantee you, I'm the only member at Metro who's ever played at Oakley. You know, it's just not on their radar, and they don't care, which is fine. They don't have to care, but someone ought to care about it, because reality is the biggest recreational land is 5 minutes down the 5 minutes the other way from Oakley, and that's called Chadstone Shopping Centre.
Yeah,
and for all the people that they're going to go on Oakley Park, you know, Oakley Golf Course turned into a park, there'll be 1,000 people at Chadstone walking around the Apple Shop, and Louis Vuitton and Gazman and, you know, Uniqlo and Angus and Grace. Pity Angus and Grace aren't there.
Yeah, well, I was thinking we haven't done that, Reid. So good on you for mentioning Angus and Grace Go Golfing, and we appreciate their support. I mean, the two clubs in Sydney that probably should take a lead on this are the Lakes and Bonnie Doon. And the reason I say that is that the Lakes and Bonnie Doon lease their sites from Sydney Water.
Didn't they do?
Yep. They lease their sites from the New South Wales government. And so the Lakes and Bonnie Doon would do well, I think, to really take a stand here and pursue it. Again, ultimately out of self-interest, but if there's some benefit to public courses in the process, that's great. Because if this is the view of the highest and best use of public space, they're both in, you know, they're not too far from Moore Park. They're surrounded by homes.
And
I'm sure there's people who'd love to picnic on the 11th at the Lakes, Mike.
They're probably safe in the short term, but who's...
Oh, totally. I mean, they're on 50-odd whatever year leases, but, you know, we won't be doing this podcast probably in 2083, but it's going to be a reality for our game. And if we're all custodians, you know, of this game, we talk about being custodians of our clubs and custodians of the game and handing it down. You know, what is our generation going to be able to say for ourselves 50 years from now about what we did to make sure the game stayed healthy?
Yeah. And your club, Matt, at Royal Melbourne, obviously have the lease at Sandringham, which is a great thing, because they've got, you know, the same access to the same ground staff and the same technology. And so it's a, you know, that's going to be an important club for, or golf course for decades to come.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, I don't know Royal Melbourne's reasons for that arrangement, but that's something that Royal Melbourne is doing for the game of golf at large, because you can pay $50 on a Monday, go to Sandringham and play a course that's prepared and conditioned and grassed exactly as Royal Melbourne is. You know, that's a legitimate, tangible thing that is great for public golfers.
Except the greens are harder.
They are firm.
They're unbelievably firm. It's
floorboard firm.
Crazy. You know, I played there about a month ago in the Hickory Day, and well, you couldn't stop anything on the green there. Yeah, it's a fun place.
I was going to mention another podcast after giving State of the Game a shout out earlier. I listened on the way to golf yesterday to Rod and Adrian Logue and Jimmy Emanuel talk to Karen Lunn, who was there with her Australian Golf Industry Council hat on. I don't know if either of you guys listened to that episode where she talked about the results of a study and provided lots of data regarding the community benefits of golf.
Yeah.
And that report was presented at Parliament House, I think almost a week ago now. That sort of stuff regarding participation numbers and the economic impact of golf being an employer and a generator of revenue and facilitating well-being of all who play the game, surely that has some place in the discussions regarding what happens in Moore Park and what happens to other municipal courses around the country.
Well, it's a century old now, but Alistair McKenzie's quote when he was working as a doctor, I gave up working as a doctor because I knew that I could better further the health of the nation by building golf courses. And he said, you know, I never saw them back in my office after I told them to go and play golf.
Yeah.
You know.
And golf really is a cradle to grave game. Like I routinely play with blokes at my current club and my previous club in their 80s, even their early 90s. And they credit it to the reason that they're still fitting well and moving around. And but again, I think golf needs to do more to make that argument. I think golf needs to harness voices like, you know, Andy Lee's a golf tragic and he's one of the most popular people in Australian media. Harness people like Andy, you know, because unfortunately, when a lot of people think about golf, aside from golfers, you know, elite golfers who are athletes, probably the most famous golfer on the planet is Donald Trump. You know, I think
I'm going to say exactly that. If you did a straw poll of the average citizen and asked them to name the first three golfers that come to mind, I'm sure that unfortunately he's one of them.
Yeah.
And it fits with this horrendously misguided view of the game that it is elite and that it's bad for the environment and it's inordinately expensive. And it's had its flaws in times past, and there's pockets of the game that are very, very costly, and it's not that way across the board, though, and it certainly isn't like that at Moore Park.
The environmental benefit is, you know, you go to Royal Melbourne, which is, by Australian terms, an elitist golf club, but by world terms, not at all. You know, there are no guards on the gate with guns stopping you coming in. I mean, anyone can walk into Royal Melbourne.
Yeah.
You know, it's the... Environmentally, it's, you know, the Sandbelt is the sole preserve of the indigenous heathland of Melbourne.
Well, it's the same in Sydney same in Sydney with the eastern suburbs Banksia scrub.
Yeah,
pretty much the only place that exists now in the eastern suburbs is on golf courses.
Yeah, so there's this strange kind of dichotomy between people who hate golf, and they don't really know why they hate it. They just hate it because they don't understand it. But they hate golf, but they love what golf courses do. You know, when Royal Sydney were cutting down 569 trees or whatever it was, out they came with their knives, and, you know, they went crazy.
Yeah.
Without understanding that what Harley Cruz is going to do when he and Gil Hance is enhance the environment by replacing the non-Indigenous stuff there with the Indigenous heathlands. So in 100 years' time, it'll be as significant as Royal Melbourne and Victoria and Peninsula and these places are in Melbourne, where... It's the golf courses are the only places where these plants are left.
Yeah.
But if you didn't play golf, you wouldn't know that.
Yeah, that's golf needs to do a better job of selling that message.
Yeah. And so I think that's you know, what's next for golf? I think this is the perfect opportunity for the game to come together in some organized collective fashion and advocate and try to get the best possible outcome for Moore Park. I think really start working on Oakley now or elsewhere. We're having the same conversation about Oakley 3 or 6 months from now.
Yeah.
And actually get people, you know, start spreading the word outside the game of golf on the great benefit, you know, that the game and its courses are offering in urban places, because at the moment, I think it's just crosshairs on every single one of them.
So when we say golf, what or who do we mean by golf?
Well, it'd be nice for Golf Australia to take some leadership, but okay. I think the leading clubs in each city, I think, have a responsibility to the game. You know, I think they might not see it that way. I think they probably see that they have responsibility just to their members, but I think it's the golf community as well. And I think, you know, those of us who pontificate on podcasts probably have a job to do and a role to play. You know, I think Golf Digest and Golf Australia magazine have a place in that. And I think there's some really, I mentioned Andy Lee before. Matthew Riley is probably Australia's most popular and successful novelist at the moment. Absolute degenerate golfer. Yeah. I mean, let's harness these voices, empower these people with the messaging and reach their communities as well. I just think, and it might not work. We might not save every course, but we have to start trying, I think, a bit more meaningfully than, you know, we are now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Ash Barty, obviously. I mean, having said that, after the referendum, is it good or bad to enlist the help of celebrities and famous people? Because that didn't work too well.
Well, that's last weekend. Well, that's true.
I think it is. I mean, I think it's incredibly.
No, but it's a fair question, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Does that not just turn people off? Here are the elites again out trying to save their sport.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's the perception problem golf has amongst a certain section of the community.
Yeah.
But anyone who plays golf in Australia knows it's a very egalitarian game. Open to everyone, welcoming to anyone. You know, it's an amazing game. And there aren't many. I mean, there are some elite clubs in Australia, sure, Royal Sydney, you know, Royal Melbourne, Metro. But Kingston Heath, Lake Carina, but there aren't that many.
No, it's a tiny amount of what golf in Australia is.
Yeah. Now, it's nothing like America, where there are, you know, hundreds of lockgate clubs over there.
Which, yeah.
You know, with the $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 joining fees and whatever. You know, I mean, golf is a much different game here than it is in America. A completely different game.
Yeah. And it's on the golf community to sell that message and to spread that word, because ultimately we're the ones who are going to lose here. And so I think it's on us as a golf community to fight that fight and push that change. No one else is going to do it for us.
And it's when you say we, I mean, you know, here's a member at Metropolitan, New South Wales and Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath saying we. I mean we're fine. But as a game and for where we all started playing, I mean, it's worth, I'll bet you Chris Minns doesn't know that the three major champions that came out of Melbourne, one of them, Peter Thompson, grew up at Royal Park, 9-hole public course. David Graham, 9-hole public course at Wattle Park. Jeff Ogilvie, 9-hole public sash member course at Cheltenham. So, you know, 9-hole public courses have produced some pretty good players over the years.
Yeah.
And from, you know, Jeff was private schoolboy, I guess, but certainly David and Peter Thompson came from the wrong side of the tracks and were, you know, golf was a way out for them.
Yeah. Well, Matt Jones grew up playing at the Aussie and then he defected to live golf. So I don't know if Sydney's necessarily got romantic a story to tell.
did they lose this morning? Didn't I see some? I saw a thing on YouTube. I wasn't sort of paying attention, but did Australia lose at the 21st hole to someone else?
I honestly couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think maybe the South Africans, maybe, I don't know. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just, what are they paying for, $50 million this week or something? I don't know what they're paying
again,
for.
Again, golf's reputation, right? Golf's perception right there.
Yeah, it's just horrendous, isn't it? It's
yeah, and $50 million from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Like, you know, why wouldn't everybody love golf when that's what they read about in the papers?
Yeah. Mind you, they're looking like the good guys at the moment.
Mm. But look, this is going to be, I think, a big thing for golf in Australia over the next couple of years. We're not going to solve it all very quickly, but I think the announcement this morning about Moore Park at least should focus everybody on, you know, the key issue, and it's a place to start.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think at some stage, probably in all of the carry on with Moore Park and what happens there in the coming months, there's going to be some sort of form of public consultation. I suspect, Scott, there'll be some sort of way in which members of that community or the broader golfing community in Sydney can express their views. So those of you who are up there and love the game like we all do, I would encourage you to participate in that. There's a feedback process that's already in place for the fate of Oakley Golf Course as well. And similarly, if you love the game of golf, it won't be very hard to go onto Sandy Jamieson's Twitter account and find the details so that you can make a submission in regard to that course. I'd encourage everyone listening to do that to help protect and nurture our game.
And of course, the great thing that's happening with public golf is that Seven Mile Beach has had 31 millimeters of rain this week. Amazing.
It's starting to
look like a golf course.
It never rains in Hobart. Having said that, they've had over an inch. But that's, you know, what, it's a segue a little bit, but what Richard Sattler, who was, I think, one of the most significant men ever in Australian golf, was at Bumboogle, was create a golf course, a public golf course, affordable public golf course, that for the first time ever, every Australian player could go and play a top 100 course in the world. You know, the Scots had Carnoustie and St Andrews and Dornoch, and the Americans had, albeit expensive, golf at Pebble Beach and Pinehurst. And Australia never had a top 100 course in the world that everyone could go and play.
Yeah.
So there's an incredibly important role for public golf, both rudimentary golf. I started playing it, I don't know if you ever played them at it, it's now called Campbell, I think, but it used to be called Bull in Public. Nine-hole course, caravan, took the money. Was 30 cents for 9 holes and 40 cents for 18. And that's where I started playing golf. It was really rudimentary golf. I don't remember if there was a bunker. There probably was, but it was just a place to hit a ball around.
Mm.
And it was important.
Yeah.
And they're all important, really. You know, and they should, that Elstermit could have been, even if they just closed it, made it a park and built a Himalayas putting green, and it was free. I don't charge people to play Himalayas putting greens. So it becomes a community place where anyone who can hold a club can hit a ball along the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't even have to be a golfer to play Himalayas putting greens.
Mm. I drove past Elstermit last night and deliberately took as much of a lap around it in the car as I could, and it is far from being a pristine nature reserve. As you said, Clates, it is.
It's just a mess, isn't it?
Yeah. And obviously hasn't had green fee revenue and dedicated staff sustaining it as a golf course has. And so there's no doubt native grasses that have grown, and it's no doubt a haven for a whole range of fauna. Whether or not that's desirable, I'm unsure. But
which is the other thing about Moore Park is you have to maintain it. It's not like you just, you know, close the golf course and say, okay, it's a park now. Well, someone's got to mow it and look after it and fill the bunkers in and do whatever they got to do to, you know, manage it.
Yeah, not many parks are revenue generating facilities,
no.
Are they?
No.
So
now, Clates, it's been some serious chat in this one. But to get you out of here, I do want to steal one question that I had for when we get you on to have some fun.
Okay. Yep.
I want to know, and we'll rule out the time that you're a touring professional because the answer's probably obvious for that time, but in the last 20 years, what's the longest you've gone without touching a golf club?
Touching a golf club or playing golf?
Both.
Touching a club. I would have thought I'd probably have every day because everyone's got a house club, right? There's always a club in the house that you swing. But I went for I went to England this year for 5 weeks and I played golf. I went via America. So I played golf with Sue O in Shady Oaks and I played with Mike DeVries at Kingsley and Crystal Downs. Then I went to England for a month and didn't play one game of golf there. Didn't take my clubs, didn't play.
Okay.
So,
that's long. That's longer than I would have thought. So,
I don't mind not playing, but I walked a golf course every day.
Yeah, you just weren't hitting shots.
I just wasn't hitting balls. And that's, you know, people that, I guess I'm odd, not them, but people complain about, you know, green fees or extortion, and they are. I mean, a mate of mine was at Troon the other day for £350, and I have just as much fun just walking around them. But I guess I get why people want to play, but, you know, I walked around a bunch of golf courses with Billy Longmuir. You know, we walked around West Sussex, which you've played West Sussex, right?
Yeah.
And what an amazing place that is. I mean, no one knows about it because it's just, you know, it's the closest thing to a sandbelt course in the Heathlands.
Yeah.
And it's 6,400 yards, par 68, really a par 67, given the first hole's a 480-yard par 5. And just a beautiful place to play golf. And with people walking through it, there was a road through it, you know, a gravel path through it. We were walking around there. There was a guy with his wife and his baby in a pusher.
Mm-hmm.
Just walking through the middle of the golf course.
Yep.
Perfect.
Yep.
So I really enjoy just walking golf courses.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is to close the loop on that topic and the topic we've been talking about, I think sharing the space is a great lesson we could take from English golf. You know, people riding horses, people walking dogs, people strolling, their kids on bikes. It is a lesson. And I think it's part of the way forward for particularly urban golf in Australia.
Yeah, I don't get that. When you've seen how well the dog golfer relationship works in England, why we don't perhaps not embrace it, but at least, you know, a couple of days a week or whatever. Yeah. Just because it works so well over there. It's amazing.
Dogs on courses might be one for another occasion. I'll jot it down for next time we chat. But thank you for making time tonight, short notice. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, look,
I'd be really interesting to see what comes next.
Yeah, it will be. It'll be fascinating.